White Network presents the International Jew Study Hour. Reading and commentary on Henry Ford's great classic about Jewish power in America.
Welcome, listeners. Thanks for joining our study hour today, August 2nd, 2012. We're covering Chapter 5 of The International Jew tonight, which is titled, Anti-Semitism, Will It Appear in the U.S.? Well, we know the answer to that, don't we? Henry Ford's writing on the Jew were begun in 1920, and it was on June 19th when this part was first published. We're going to find that the men who wrote this were pretty idealistic about the Jewish question in thinking that America might be the place where the problem of the Jews would be solved. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and my co-host and our designated reader is Hadding Scott. Hello, Hadding.
Hello.
Well, it's always so good to have you on board. Very reassuring. tonight, we're going to begin by finishing up the last couple of paragraphs from last week's chapter, The Jewish Question, Fact or Fancy. Of course, Ford and his writers considered it fact. And last week, there was also a comment from a listener about Napoleon that I didn't get to.
That was in response to something that I interjected about the origin of the idea that the Jews were fundamentally just like everybody else, and only externally Jewish, rather than being Jews and essentially different.
Okay, good. Well, I think this listener didn't agree with that. He sent in and said he wanted us to know some things about Napoleon. He said Napoleon ensured freedom of religions and equality to the Protestant sects. And he declared France the homeland of the Jews. I don't know if he did go that far. After it became obvious he could not establish their national home in Palestine. Did he try to do that?
I don't know.
I don't either. I don't know. But I looked up in Wikipedia, and I found a kind of interesting couple of statements. So I'm going to read those. Napoleon stated, this is a quote supposedly, I will never accept any proposals that will obligate the Jewish people to leave France, because to me, the Jews are the same as any other citizen in our country. See? It takes weakness to chase them out of the country, but it takes strength to assimilate them.
Well, there you go. The Jews are the same as every other citizen.
Yeah, that's what he established. And was he one of the first to do that?
I think so. Many of the American colonies had the requirement that you had to be a Christian in order to hold office until well into the 19th century.
Oh, we used to be so smart. Okay, then another statement by Napoleon. Well, this is about him. He was seen as so favorable to the Jews that the Russian Orthodox Church formally condemned him as Antichrist and the enemy of God. So the Russian Orthodox Church was, and still is, I think, pretty anti-Jewish, but not Napoleon.
Yes.
And now look at France.
He was a Freemason, so it fits. But, they say that he also went against the bankers at some point.
Yes. See, I've heard these contradictory things. Now, this listener also wrote more. He said, in July 1806, the Emperor Napoleon I called a meeting of 111 rabbis and Jewish laymen to Paris. They assembled in the Hotel de Ville in order to answer some questions for which the emperor wanted answers. These questions were, are Jews polygamous? That's number one. Number two, do they allow the marriage of Jews to Christians? Three, do rabbis claim the right to grant divorces independent of the civil authorities? And four, do the Jews consider usury lawful? Now, you know, this listener sent this in, didn't give any source for it, and I don't know really what, we don't have the answers to any of this, so it's not real helpful.
Well, I read that before. That's what I had in mind last week.
Okay.
Yeah, okay. I remember there was some kind of assembly where Napoleon asked the Jews a lot of questions, and that was, I believe, where they established that Jews would be considered as fundamentally just like every other citizen of France. And only
they knew what he wanted, so they gave him the answers that would work out.
Although, I mean, there are Jews to this day who will say that they are national Jews rather than, you know, international Jews. Like this Roger Domergue Polaco de Menache, the Jewish revisionist.
Yeah, well, he's a good guy. Yeah.
He describes himself as a national Jew.
Well, he's probably one of the few. He's truthful when he says that. Right?
Apparently.
I think so. I've never seen anything but good about him. There are some like that. All right. You were trying to finish chapter 4, and I kept saying, oh, we can't finish it. We'll pull it for next week. And so we're going to cover, you're going to read wherever you decide, the very ending there, so we can...
Right.
Talk about some of these.
Okay.
We're in chapter 4, folks, still.
Just to give some context, the preceding paragraph, the last paragraph that we covered last week, that talked about a Jewish international financial network that was able to inflict misery on particular nations that didn't do things that they wanted done. So here we pick up. This system, if it ever existed, exists in greater power today. It is today, however, threatened as it has never been. 50 years ago, international banking, which was mostly in control of the Jews as the money brokers of the world, was on top of business. It exercised the super control of governments and finance everywhere. Then came that new thing, industry, which expanded to a degree unguessed by the shrewdest prophets and analysts. As industry gathered strength and power, it became a powerful money magnet, drawing the wealth of the world in its train. Not, however, merely for the sake of possessing the money, but of making it work. Production and profit on production, instead of loans and interest on loans, became the master method for a time. The war came, in which the former broker masters of the world had undoubtedly their large part. It means the First World War. And now the two forces, industry and finance, are in a struggle to see whether finance is again to become the master, or creative industry to become the master. This is one of the elements which is bringing the Jewish question to the bar of public opinion. That was a big part of the conflict that National Socialism addressed in Gottfried Feder's manifesto. He talks about how finance capital has a huge advantage in the long run over industrial capital, that the industrial capitalist, unlike the finance capitalist, is involved in making things. See, the advantage that the finance capitalist has is that since his profits are only based on mathematics, which is to say lending out some quantity of money and then through compound interest having the amount that is due to him increase exponentially forever and ever. The finance capitalist, if everybody plays by the rules and debts are never canceled, or at least interest is never canceled, the bankers eventually end up owning the world. Okay. Whereas industrial capitalists, their power doesn't grow in the same way. The industrial capitalists start up and their business grows pretty fast if they're successful. And then it levels off at some point.
But the Ford writers here thought that industry was going to, take over or equal the finance capitalists?
Well, he seems to be saying that that they were sort of on an equal basis around the time of the First World War. the Nationals. See, you can. One of the big complaints of National Socialists was about the alliance between international finance and social democrats. You can see why international finance would support the social democrats, who are Marxist revisionists. It's because in Marxist theory, there's no talk about international finance as a source of troubles. Only the industrial capitalist is marked as an enemy of the worker.
Yeah.
And National Socialists point out the industrialist is not the enemy of the worker. The worker and the industrialist need each other.
Yes, that's right.
It's the banker that's the fifth wheel.
Yeah, right. Okay, that's clear.
Okay. To state this and to prove it may be nothing more than to establish the superiority of Jewish ability. Certainly, it is not a tenable position to say that the Jew is extraordinarily successful and therefore must be curbed. It would be equally aside from the truth to say that the coordination of Jewish activity has been, on the whole, a harmful thing for the world. It may be useful to show that up to this point, it has been useful. Success cannot be attacked nor condemned. If any moral question arises at all, it must concern the use made of the success which has been attained. That's a big issue right there.
Well, you know, right off the bat, I don't agree with either of those statements, that it's not tenable to say that the Jew's extraordinary success must be curbed. I think, yes, it is tenable. We've learned that. They might not have known that then. It may not have looked that way then, but it does now. And then to say that you can't say that it wouldn't be truthful to say that that Jewish activity, as it coordinates with itself, is a harmful thing for the world. Why say no? It's not wrong to say that. I mean, it's not untruthful. That is the truth. And we've seen that now, but they don't want to say that you should stop people from being so successful. You know, that success in itself is such a good thing that you can't say that it's not good, but it can be not good. The Jew's success in the world certainly hasn't been a good thing. That's just my opinion.
Well, it's not a good thing if you're trying to have an independent nation to have a bunch of foreigners come in and acquire a lot of power.
Yeah, I mean, fine if the Jews are successful if they're playing along with the same kind of rules and thinking that other people are, but they're not. They're different. They're different. And so, anyway, that's what strikes me there.
Okay.
And then we're going to find more of that in this upcoming chapter, where they're just trying to be so fair and even praising the Jew for his wonderful qualities, you know, which we've already run into. But they really get pretty carried away with it, I think, in the is it the fifth chapter?
Yeah.
So we'll get there.
Okay. If any moral question arises at all, it must concern the use made of the success which has been attained. The whole matter centers there after the previous fact is established. May the Jew go on as he has gone, or does his duty to the world require another use of his success? This inquiry obviously leads to further discussion, as well as a gathering up of the remaining threads of the present discussion, which future articles will attempt to do.
Yeah.
Okay, so now we're at chapter
5.
Yeah, 5. Anti-Semitism, will it appear in the U.S.? And just before that, they give us a little quote from Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, Louis D. Brandeis. This is from a book that he wrote called Zionism on pages 113 and 114. Okay, so Louis D. Brandeis said, to this end, we must organize. Organize in the first place so that the world may have proof of the extent and the intensity of our desire for liberty. Organize in the second place so that our resources may become known and be made available. Organize, organize, organize until every Jew must stand up and be counted, counted with us, or prove himself wittingly or unwittingly of the few who are against their own people.
Yeah, now that's, you know, there it is. It always comes to this. The Jew, every Jew must stand up and be counted with us. And if not, he proves himself that he's against his own people.
Yeah, right, right.
Yeah.
You're with us or you're against us. It's a completely vulgar and simplistic attitude.
Yeah, and they don't allow any Jew to have a different opinion, like the Jew apologists are always saying, well, they're not all alike. Oh, they don't all agree. Well, if they don't agree, they're going to be given a real hard time. So they mostly do. Okay.
Yeah, so, and apparently that's supposed to be an example of a Jew promoting, provoking anti-Semitism with his attitude.
Well, I think you're right. I think that's what they intended. Yeah, it does.
All right, so here we go. Anti-Semitism, will it appear in the U.S.? Anyone who essays to discuss the Jewish question in the United States or anywhere else must be fully prepared to be regarded as an anti-Semite in highbrow language or in lowbrow language, a Jew-baiter. Nor need encouragement be looked for from people or from press. The people who are awake to the subject at all prefer to wait and see how it all turns out. While there is probably not a newspaper in America, and certainly none of the advertising mediums which are called magazines, which would have the temerity even to breathe seriously the fact that such a question exists. The press in general is open at this time to fulsome editorials in favor of everything Jewish, specimens of the same being obtainable almost anywhere, while the Jewish press, which is fairly numerous in the United States, takes care of the vituperative end.
Well, I'll just stick in here that nothing has changed. You know, this is the same as 100 years ago as it is now, only we're going to find that they think that that things are at this stage, but they can change them. And it's America that will change the Jew.
Yeah.
And change the experience with the Jew.
That was the optimism back then. And, you know, yeah. Some Jews did assimilate, but not all of them.
Okay, maybe we don't know they're Jews anymore, the ones that assimilate.
Yeah, well, you can
they
meet
really
a few.
They really did assimilate.
You can meet a few here and there that will say, well, there was a... Usually these people have some anti-Jewish attitudes.
The Jews, so that assimilated.
Like a great-grandfather, yeah. Or somebody that was a Jew that decided yeah. He didn't want to be a Jew anymore. Of course, the only acceptable explanation of any public discussion at present of the Jewish question is that someone... writer or publisher or related interest is a Jew hater. That idea seems to be fixed. It is fixed in the Jew by inheritance. It is sought to be fixed in the Gentile by propaganda, that any writing which does not simply cloy and drip in syrupy sweetness toward things Jewish is born of prejudice and hatred. It is, therefore, full of lies, insult, insinuation, and constitutes an instigation to massacre. These terms are culled at random from Jewish editorial utterances at hand. So these are things that they actually said.
Yeah.
It would seem to be necessary for our Jewish citizens to enlarge their classification of Gentiles to include the class which recognizes the existence of a Jewish question and still is not anti-Semitic.
Well, this is this class is where Jet Rucker, who was on my program Monday night, belongs. He recognizes the existence of a Jewish question, but he really is not anti-Semitic. And there are a lot of people like him, and where he comes from, you know, that you could say that of. You couldn't say that about me, but you could say that about someone like him.
And well, this is I wouldn't be anti-Semitic by some people's definition. Probably. I mean, I've been in discussions where I was being probed about my attitudes in a somewhat hostile way. And some Jew would say, well, that's not really anti-Semitic. And I almost want to say, well, don't let me off the hook here. You know, don't cut me any slack. Come on, just call me anti-Semitic. Because otherwise, you're kind of patting me on the head and doing me a favor there. And I don't want to be condescended to, you know. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I have criticisms of the Jews. So, I mean, if that's anti-Semitic, then call me anti-Semitic.
Well, they pointed out just a little bit above here that, yeah, that according to the Jews, even then, you know, again, I point out 100 years ago that that if you didn't just speak in sweet therapy terms about the Jews, well, it's because you hated Jews and you were anti-Semitic. So.
Yeah, I just resent this this business of they're having the sitting in judgment over everybody else, whether they're anti-Semitic or not. And you're a good boy if you're not anti-Semitic.
It's really ridiculous.
Irritates me.
They've given so much. I mean, they're allowed to get away with it.
Yeah.
It's just ridiculous. Okay, let's go on.
Okay,
come up again.
There are four distinct parties traceable among the Jews themselves. First, those whose passionate purpose is to keep Jewish faith and First, those whose passionate purpose is to keep Jewish faith and life alive at the cost of any sacrifice of popularity or success. Second, those who are willing to make whatever sacrifice may be needed to preserve Jewish religion, but are not so particular about the traditional customs of Jewish life. Third, those who have no very strong convictions either way, but are opportunists and will always swerve in the direction of success. And fourth, those who believe and preach that the only solution of the differences between the Jew and other men is the complete absorption of the Jewish race by the other races. The fourth is the weakest, most unpopular, and least to be considered of all the parties. With Gentiles, there are only two classes as far as this special question is concerned. Those who dislike Jews, they cannot tell why, and those who are disposed to fairness in spite of the accident of congeniality or uncongeniality, and who recognize the Jewish question as at least a problem. Both these attitudes, whenever they become apparent, are subject to the charge of anti-Semitism. Anti-Semitism is a term which is bandied about too loosely. It ought to be reserved to denote the real anti-Jewish temper of violent prejudice. If used indiscriminately about all who attempt to discuss Jewish characteristics and Jewish world power, it may in time arrive at the estate of respectability and honor.
Well, see, this is what I think has happened. Yeah, with people like me. I mean, anti-Semitism is an honorable attitude of people that we all deem to be respectable. And here you have this, here I'm going to bring up this latest thing that's been in the news of Hannah Rosenthal, who is the State Department representative or head of that agency that was created to try to stop anti-Semitism all around the world, you know, our State Department. And, of course, it's always been headed by a Jew and has all these Jews working there. And what she has now done is to make it include in the official State Department reports any ideas that they have determined that there's increasing anti-Semitism somewhere. Before, they were just in the special reports of this agency, but now they're being put in all the State Department reports, some official State Department reports. And this was not done under George W. Bush. Under George W. Bush, he allowed them to have their special reports. But now under Barack Obama and this Hannah Rosenthal, now they're in the official State Department reports. If they decide that there's some increase in anti-Semitism there. This is so ridiculous that, you know, that we should be having this in the United States government.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And also they said in that article, and it was by a Jewish newspaper, that there was no evidence given as to what they were using for when they reported increase. They were reporting these increases in anti-Semitism in various places, but they don't give any they don't document what they're using to determine that, you know. They just say it.
Yeah.
Yeah, it's just sickening.
Well, you know, also this idea that a word can lose its power is something that conservatives don't seem to appreciate very much. You know, they don't challenge things like that. They just accept that if a word has its power, they just have to accept it, and they don't realize that you can change the way things are perceived.
Yeah, we do have to challenge that. We do.
Yeah. And by the way, the National Socialists said straight up, in at least in this booklet called Politische Fibel, which was like a set of outlines for lectures to indoctrinate new members of the National Socialist Party. It says in there, we National Socialists are anti-Semites. Says it.
Yeah,
straight.
Yeah, I know. Yeah, well, I don't know that book, but I was looking there's a speech I've read that Hitler gave in like in 1920 or so, something like that, early 21 or 1919, and it was why we are anti-Semites, and yeah. I can't find that speech. You know, I can't find the text of it anywhere, and I've looked in all kinds of places.
So there's
if anybody knows of it or can send it to me, I wish they would. I would really, really want to read that.
So there's the respectability and honor there. All right.
Yeah,
anti-Semitism.
Yeah.
Anti-Semitism in almost every form is bound to come to the United States. Indeed, it may be said that it is here now and has been here for a long time. If it be mislabeled now, the United States will not be able to work within it the transformation which has been effected upon so many other ideas that have arrived here in their journey around the globe.
Mm-hmm.
It may be serviceable. It may be a serviceable clearing of the ground to define what anti-Semitism is not. One, it is not recognition of the Jewish question. If it were, then it could be set down that the bulk of the American people are destined to become anti-Semites. Four, they are beginning to recognize the existence of a Jewish question and will steadily do so in increasing numbers as the question is forced upon them from the various practical angles of their lives. The question is here. We may be honestly blind to it. We may be timidly silent about it. We may even make dishonest denial of it. But it is here. In time, all will have to recognize it. In time, the polite hush-hush of oversensitive or intimidated circles will not be powerful enough to suppress it. But to recognize it will not mean that we have gone over to a campaign of hatred and enmity against the Jews. It will only mean that a stream of tendency which has been flowing through our civilization has at last accumulated bulk and power enough to challenge attention, to call for some decision with regard to it, to call for the adoption of a policy which will not repeat the mistakes of the past and yet will forestall any possible social menace of the future.
Well, I say to this, I underlined that, and I put a question here. Is it more or less here now than it was in the past? I'm not so sure. He says that, you know, it's here with us now. it's here with us today. I wonder, what am I asking here? Was it not as strong then? Is it stronger now? Or is it just the same? I know what I was thinking was maybe it has diminished. You know, that at that time he said that everybody, so many white Americans were aware of it and sensitive to it, but they weren't really, didn't want to say too much about it. But I think we've become insensitized to it. And most people don't even recognize it or say they don't. There's a, of course, people in our circles do, but other Americans. You know what I'm saying?
I think a big part of it is the Jews are less conspicuous now. When they first came off the boat, you know, they were speaking Yiddish. They lived in Eastern Europe. You know, they didn't bathe regularly.
Yeah. Well, but were people against Jews for that reason? It's always, even in this article, it's mostly economic. It's economic reasons. So I don't see why people would be so concerned about Yiddish-speaking immigrants who were poor, unless they were taking their jobs, but most of them were in New York City, and well, they were actually a lot of places. But now we have this awareness of all this Jewish power in this country, and yet I don't know what the feeling was then. They're making out that it was pretty strong.
Although there were a few things. For one thing, a lot of Jews were involved in anarchism.
Yes.
Before the Bolshevik Revolution, you know, the Jewish subversives were more likely to be anarchists than communists.
Well, I bet people in the middle America didn't know much about that.
I bet they did.
Didn't pay much attention. Oh, you think so?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Because
this guy Joel Gosch that assassinated President McKinley. I think that was 1901. Mm-hmm. He was inspired by a speech given by Emma Goldman.
Okay, well, you know, he was one of those strange ones who was listening to Emma Goldman.
Yeah.
I wonder how
there was a lot of, there was a lot of stuff going on in relation to Jewish anarchists in the first decade of the 20th century. If you look in the New York Times from that period, you'll see lots of stuff.
Well, I know my grandparents, my grandfathers paid a lot of attention. And one grandfather I was around, and I know how much attention he paid to all the news and everything. Like so many people, I wish now that I had any reason to think that I should, at that time, I could have asked them a lot of questions and found out a lot and even written it all down. None of that ever occurred to me because I didn't have any questions then, you know.
So there were the Jewish anarchists, which Jews were very notorious for being anarchist agitators at that time. And there were some other things. Jews were trying and succeeding at turning over a lot of laws. They overturned the blue laws against doing business on Sunday.
Yeah.
In some states.
Yeah, that's going to come up in one of these chapters that I read in the First Freedom newspaper. Really, it's an amazing chapter where he goes into all these things that the Jews succeeded in overturning in these vastly majority Christian organizations and city councils and so on. You know, it's such a lesson. Well, let's go
and,
on.
They also formed the NAACP around that time.
Around what time?
NAACP. Before 1920, sometime before 1920.
Yeah, right.
It was formed by Jews.
Yes, it was.
And it was, okay. Let's see. Let's continue.
Number two.
Again, the public discussion of the Jewish question is not anti-Semitism. Yeah, let's see if the Jews will say that. Publicity is sanitary. The publicity given the Jewish question or certain aspects of it in this country has been very misleading. It has been discussed more fully in the Jewish press than elsewhere, but not with candor or breadth of vision. Wow, Jews lack candor, they lack breadth of vision. Amazing. The two dominant notes, they are sounded over and over again with monotonous regularity in the Jewish press, are Gentile unfairness and Christian prejudice. These apparently are the two chief aspects of life which impress Jewish publicists when they look over the line of their own race. It is said in all soberness that it is fortunate for Jews generally that the Jewish press does not circulate very widely among Gentiles, for it is probably the one established agency in the United States which, without altering its program in the least, could stir up anti-Jewish sentiment by the simple expedient of a general reading among non-Jews. Jewish writers writing for Jewish readers present unusual material for the study of race consciousness and its accompaniment of contempt for other races. It is true that in the publications referred to, America is constantly praised, but not America as the land of the American people, America rather as the land of the Jews' opportunity.
That is a great line. That should be put in carved in stone or something, or, you know, that should be remembered and repeated.
Reminds me, you know, of Leonard Bernstein's West Side Story. There's that mm-hmm. song, Only in America, Land of Opportunity. Yeah. Right? See,
that's right. That's what
it was. It's a bunch of Puerto Ricans, but it's really about Jews, somehow or other.
Yeah, but, well, down further along in this chapter, something similar is said, and I make the comment there, too, that, you know, Jews talk about how they love America, and it's just this, what an opportunity America was for them, and how successful they've become. They don't love Americans, though. They don't love us. They don't love, you know, the people that were here already. They just love the way America is set up. Well, what is a republic of with all this freedom and liberty for everyone?
You know what? I used to, before I was really Jew aware, I had this Jewish acquaintance that wanted to be my friend, and he would say some really outlandish things sometimes. You can decide for yourself to what extent he had his tongue in his cheek when he said this. He said that he loved Israel, but America was better because there were more people to exploit.
Well, he actually said that.
Oh, yeah.
Well, they do. I knew some Jews at one point that were, they were like crooks. I mean, their business was like just taking advantage of, in this case, it was like Puerto Ricans, yeah, and Mexicans and so on in their neighborhoods with the business that they had there. And they would talk about it and laugh and laugh and laugh.
Yeah.
They were so, you know, that's what they do. That's what Jews do.
They get a kick out of it, some of them.
Yeah.
They
yeah.
get a big kick out of taking advantage, being dishonest, getting away with it.
Yeah, well, these ones did.
Okay. On the side of the daily press, there has been no serious discussion at all. This is neither surprising nor reprehensible. The daily press deals with matters that have reached the overheated stage. When it mentions the Jews at all, it has stock phrases for the purpose. The effort includes a list of the famous Jews of history and usually closes with a complimentary reference to certain local Jews of commendable qualities, whose advertisements are not infrequently found in another part of the paper. Summing up, it may be said that the publicity given the question in this country consists in misrepresentative criticism of the Gentiles by the Jewish press and misrepresentative praise of the Jews by the non-Jewish press. An independent effort to give a constructive publicity cannot, therefore, be laid to anti-Semitism, even when some of the statements which are made in the course of it arouse the resentment of Jewish readers. 3. Nor is it anti-Semitism to say that the suspicion is abroad in every capital of civilization and the certainty is held by a number of important men that there is active in the world a plan to control the world, not by territorial acquisition, not by military aggression, nor by governmental subjection, not even by economic control in the scientific sense, but by control of the machinery of commerce and exchange. It is not
That's pretty important, too,
yeah.
What's said there. I mean, they're saying there's an active plan in the world to control the world by Jews through the machinery of commerce and exchange. And this seems to be kind of the basic theme of the international Jew, because they go after, the business Jew. It's all about how they conduct business.
It is not anti-Semitism to say that, nor to present the evidence which supports that, nor to bring proof of that. Those who could best disprove it, if it were not true, are the international Jews themselves. But they have not disproved it. Those who could best prove it would be those Jews whose ideals include the good of the whole of humanity on an equality, and not the good of one race only. But they have not proved it. Someday, a prophetic Jew may arise who will see that the promises bestowed upon the ancient people are not to be fulfilled by Rothschild methods, and that the promise that all the nations were to be blessed through Israel is not to be fulfilled by making the nations the economic vassals of Israel. And when that time comes, we may hope for a redirection of Jewish energy into channels that will drain the present sources of the Jewish question. In the meantime, it is not anti-Semitism. It may even be found to be a world service to the Jew to throw light on what purpose motivates certain higher circles. If the above propositions are true, then the term anti-Semitic, so freely bestowed on this series of articles, betrays a worse spirit in the critics than in the author. But enough of that. There is much yet to do, and what is done must stand on what merit remains after friend and foe alike are through with praise and blame.
Well, they're saying here that they're already being accused of anti-Semitism.
Yeah, well, of
these
course.
These articles. Yeah, and this is chapter 5. I don't know how much of each one was put into the newspaper every week, but anyway, how long this has been going on. But this is only June 20th, 1920. I think it was June 20th this one was published. So it's still early, and amongst the early ones, and so that might be why they're writing so much about anti-Semitism here, because they've been accused of it.
Yeah. Okay. Anti-Semitism has unquestionably swayed large sections of humanity at various times, warping the vision, twisting the characters, and staining the hands of its victims. But the most amazing statement that could be made of it is that it has never accomplished anything in behalf of those who used it, and it has never taught anything to the Jews against whom it was used. The grades of anti-Semitism are fairly numerous, and a few of them may be cited here. 1. There is first that degree of anti-Semitism, if it may be so described, which consists in a plain dislike of the Jew as a person, no matter who he may be. This is often found in people of all grades. It is found mostly, however, in those whose contact with Jews has been very limited. It begins sometimes in childhood with an instinctive dislike for the word Jew. It is encouraged by the misuse of the word Jew as an epithet or as an adjective generally descriptive of unpopular practices. The feeling is not different from that which exists toward Gentiles concerning whom the same notions are held, but it differs in that it is extended to the race of unknown individual Jews instead of being restricted to known individuals who may justify such a feeling. Congeniality is not within our choice, but control of the sentiment of uncongeniality is. Every fair-minded person is compelled, at times, to reflect that it is not impossible that the person for whom he feels a dislike may be as good and possibly a better person than he. Our dislike merely registers the result of attraction and repulsion as they operate between another person and oneself. It does not indicate that the disliked person is unworthy. Of course, wherever intelligence is joined with this instinctive withdrawal from social contact with members of the Jewish race, prejudice is forestalled. Except, of course, in those persons who hold that there are no individuals among the Jews worthy of respect. This is an extreme attitude.
Yes, it is.
And is composed of other elements beside natural dislike. It is possible for people to dislike Jews and not be anti-Semitic. Indeed, it is not at all uncommon. It grows more and more common that intelligent and refined Jews themselves do not relish the society of their own people, except in cases of exceptional refinement.
Well, here, you know, you're talking about, they're lumping the whole group together as Jews, saying that people dislike Jews, but they're not anti-Semitic. Why do people dislike Jews so much? I mean, it begs the question, doesn't it, here, that even Jews don't like Jews, certain Jews. But in the end, they will still help them out. They will still be all this Jewish philanthropy, and they will still identify as their, you know, Jewish group, and they will still want them to do well. So, everything is even amongst the Jews, they underline the things that they accuse us of doing without any reason, but there is plenty of reason for it, and they even talk about that. I mean, it's obvious that there's a problem with these people. Well, I keep saying that.
There's a stereotype about the Sephardic Jews that have been in the United States for a long time, especially ones that had lived in the South and whose ancestors, many had been slave owners, that they had a low view of the Ashkenazi Jews that mostly came in after the war between the states. That's kind of true.
I've heard that often enough.
And David Irving likes to quote some statement of Franklin Roosevelt's that expresses disdain for Jews that were on his cabinet. But, you know, Irving doesn't take account of the fact that the Roosevelts, if they're Jews, which you can actually find some books now that will say that Roosevelt was at least partly of Jewish ancestry.
I think so. After I looked into it, I just thought it was pretty obvious, although it's not proven, you know.
Yeah. Well, he made some kind of concessive remark once. Roosevelt did, that he may have had some Jewish ancestry. But
yeah,
he did.
Instead of saying, no, I don't, he said, well, I might, you know, if I do, I don't care. That was a strange statement, I thought.
Yeah.
Don't be anti-Semitic. I'm not anti-Semitic, so I don't care at all whether I have, you know, whether some of my ancestors were Jewish or not. I mean, of course people like him want to know who their ancestors were. He was an upper-class patrician. They all know all about him.
Well, he didn't marry a second cousin for no reason.
Yeah.
She was no beauty queen. Come on. But anyway, yeah, that's my answer to David Irving's argument that the fact that Roosevelt had some negative things about some of his Ashkenazi Jew associates means that he wasn't a Jew. It doesn't mean that at all. It means he was a Sephardic Jew. All right. This really calls for some comment on the manners and characteristics of the ordinary member of the Jewish race. The accidents of behavior which stand out most obnoxiously and of which Jews themselves are often the most unsparing critics. But these comments must fall into place later. Two. A second stage of...
This is three, right?
It says two there.
Oh, I've got my numbers mixed up then, because I didn't have a number at all for two. Okay, you're right, then it's two.
A second stage of the spirit of anti-Semitism may be designated as hatred and enmity. It should be noted that the antipathy referred to immediately above was not hatred. Dislike is not hatred, nor is it necessarily enmity. One may dislike sugar in his tea without troubling to hate sugar. But undoubtedly, there are people who, because they have let their dislikes deepen into prejudice, and perhaps also because of unpleasant experiences with members of the Jewish race, probably a million Americans have been brought to the verge of becoming Jew haters this winter because of contact with Jewish merchants and landlords, may be classified as at least incipient anti-Semites. Well, that was rough. But undoubtedly, there are people who, because they have let their dislikes deepen into prejudice, and perhaps also because of unpleasant experiences with members of the Jewish race, may be classified as at least incipient anti-Semites. This is most of all unfortunate for the persons who harbor these emotions. It is unfortunate in that it unfits the mind to consider intelligently the facts which constitute the Jewish question, and also unfits it to deal with them in a fair and constructive way. For one's own sake, whatever the provocation otherwise, it is better not to let passion deflect the needle of one's mind. Hatred at the wheel means hazard on the course. Enmity lives in the vicinity of Jews more than of any other race, and the reason for this is one of the puzzles of the ages. The Jewish nature itself, as shown in ancient and modern history, is not without its own share of enmity, and it either evokes or provokes enmity where it comes in contact with those Aryan races which follow their natural impulses, unchecked by cultural and ethical influences. This age-long conflict of the Jew has puzzled the minds of students for generations. Some explain it biblically as the curse of Jehovah upon his chosen people for their disobedience to the discipline by which he would have made them the prophet nation of the world. If this offense must come, if it is part of the Jew's heritage, an old saying, Christian and scriptural, by the way, would still remain true. It must needs be that offenses come, but woe to that man by whom the offense cometh.
Well, you know, I have to say that when they're always bringing in the Bible into this question, it does make it harder. It makes our job harder, because then people get all caught up in talking about what the Bible means, as though that's going to answer, you know, that we'll find the answer there. And, of course, I totally cannot go along with the idea that, well, I don't even think these Jews were those people back then. And so they weren't the ones who were, that God was going to make prophet nation of the world. And this whole idea doesn't help in trying to understand the Jew. If you want to think that God is creating some favored group.
Yeah. I looked up the context of that quote. That's from Matthew 18:7. It says, it's in the context of where Jesus is talking about I think he says little ones that believe in him. And
yes, that's what I thought it was.
Says, woe unto the world because of offenses, for it must needs be that offenses come. And offenses is also translated as causing these little ones to stumble. In other words, causing Christians to sin. But woe to that.
It's related to children, to being, although maybe that's symbolic, idea of children, but it is related to the little ones,
But woe to that man by whom the offense comes. So it's much more applicable against the Jews than against any anti-Jew. Say you have Jewish pornographers causing Christians to sin. If thine eye offend, pluck it out. Well, in that case, we got to get rid of the Jews, right?
Okay, that sounds right.
And there's also cross-reference. Woe to that man by whom the Son of Man is betrayed. That's Matthew 26:24.
Okay.
All right. Section 3. In some parts of the world at various times, this feeling of hatred has broken into murderous violence, which has roused, as wholesale physical outrage always does, the horror and resentment of humanity. This is the extreme form in which anti-Semitism has exhibited itself, and it is the charge of intending to stimulate it here and elsewhere, which every public discussion of the Jewish question has to bear. There is, of course,
this is talking about things like pogroms, isn't it? And I'm saying, where does this happen here in the United States? This hardly ever happened in the United
States. Against Jews, no.
No, not against Jews, right. Except when that guy in the South, that Jew, and I can't remember.
Killed Mary Fagan.
Yeah, Mary Fagan.
That's a factory manager.
That's the only time, the only one I know of.
Leo Frank.
Yes, Leo Frank.
Yeah, McDonald says that was the beginning of a Jewish vendetta against the South.
Well, and that was when the ADL formed.
Yeah, yes, that's right.
I think afterwards. Well, yeah. We have to defend ourselves.
In reaction to it.
Yeah.
There is, of course, no excuse for these outbreaks, but, yeah, and by the way, that was Leo Frank. I mean, I don't think he was lynched. I mean, yeah, eventually he was lynched, but I'm saying the court, I don't think it was a kangaroo court that convicted him. They wanted to, they would have probably would have rather found the black guy guilty. But the evidence
he was the guilty one. Yeah. He definitely was guilty.
Eventually, and the governor pardoned Leo Frank, or commuted his sentence. And
wasn't that at the urging of the Jewish community or whatever?
Somehow or other, you know, they've got connections with Freemasonry and all that. They can pull strings.
Well, now look, now this guy was a Jew, Leo Frank, and look how the Jews were not willing to have him be guilty, even though he was guilty. Now, Christians are not like that. Nobody else is like that. If somebody's guilty of something like that, raping and murdering a young girl that works for you, you're not going to try to save him, but the Jews did and insisted he was innocent. This is the difference. This is a huge difference in the way they
so
think.
So local people with the sheriff leading them, I think, they broke into the prison and took him out and hanged him.
You know, we've only got a couple minutes left.
Yep. There is, of course, no excuse for these outbreaks. But there is sufficient explanation of them. The Jews usually explain them as expressions of religious prejudice, and the Gentiles as rebellion against an economic yoke which the Jews have woven for the people. We can stop right there, I guess.
Okay. Well, then we will. I thought it would take us 2 weeks, so we will continue with this next week, ladies and gentlemen, our listeners. It will be. We'll finish this off. And maybe we'll have a lot to say about it, and we'll wait until the following week to start the next chapter. But anyway, it'll move along as it should. So I think this was a good show, Hattie.
It was okay.
I thought it was pretty interesting. Yeah, I think so, even though we only got halfway through. Well, we've got 10 seconds. I want to thank our listeners, and I want to thank, of course, you, and you can thank me. And
well, thank you, Carolyn.
I hate to always be thanking you like I'm in charge of everything. But okay, that's it, folks. Come back next week for more International Jewish Studies. Hooray, Jake,
hooray, John, breaking up drinks all night long.
Thanks for listening. The International Jew Study Hour will return next week, exclusively on the White Network.